You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Betty Daly will be telling us about Family Alliance Ontario.
So what can you tell me about the Family Alliance and their work with folks with disabilities?
So Family Alliance is a network of people with disabilities and families who have a family member with an intellectual disability, mostly. It was created in 1992, so that means it's over 25 years old. It was created because families really wanted a voice about the supports that their sons and daughters were getting, and they didn't tend to have that voice. So it came from, so I was involved in 1992 when it came about, and at that point services were really trying to influence or control what families say and how they said it. And families, of course, as you could imagine, weren't that easily controlled because we wanted certain things, and what we wanted was really our voices to be heard and people themselves, their voices being heard. And the only voice that was being heard was the service system. So that's where the organization sprang from. So it's been around a long time. Our main goal is to really look at the issues that people with disabilities and their families are facing, and then advocate for change. It's also an organization that connects families with one another, because connection and having that mutual support is very, very important to families. So that's what we have spent the last 25 plus years on, is ensuring that families know each other, connect with each other, support each other, and that there's some advocacy done around the issues that families identify as the most important issues. So go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just wondering, when you mentioned in the early days how some of the disability voices were being sort of suppressed, I was wondering how you worked around that, how you actually got your voices to be heard and included.
Well, we left the organization that founded what was called then the Family Support Institute. And we created our own Family Alliance Ontario outside of the service system, because the service system had always sponsored and helped organize families. So that's how we birthed Family Alliance Ontario. How we got our voices heard is just really identifying the issues, bringing them forward, sitting at all of the tables that were discussing the issues, and really advocating for people with disabilities and their families and extended families to be involved in the decision making. And the ministry back then felt that that was important to do. So they included families and People First Ontario particularly, in all of the organization functions that they had to help make sure that people's voices were heard. Now, unfortunately, that is not happening today, which is one of the main issues that Family Alliance has, is that the government is no longer listening to people with disabilities themselves or their extended family about the issues that are important to them. They are listening to service providers. And service providers have a vested interest, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's a vested interest in ensuring that their organizations flourish and survive. And to that end, sometimes that isn't always in the best interest of the people that they serve. So that is one of our main issues because, for example, the Ministry of Community, Children and Social Services meets monthly with service providers. We have been unable over the last few years to even get a meeting with the ministry. So. And I know that People First Ontario is in the same position. They have not been able to get that voice heard, because this ministry is more interested in the service providers coming up with solutions for people with disabilities than those most directly affected by the services and the supports that are created. So we have been really advocating for change. We felt that Journey to Belonging was a change and that we could finally be involved in creating things. But again, the government of Ontario really looks at the service providers to create anything that is comes out of Journey to Belonging. So the service providers are involved in creating what would be called individualized funding, not the people themselves and not their families.
So,
and again, it's not in their best interest to have individualized funding, and that really creates a dichotomy where those most effective really are at the discretion of the services that the ministry has created.
So how do we get beyond that?
Right now, there's 52,000 people with disabilities waiting for service. And that's from the papers at Community Living Ontario, from their research. So if you're an organization or a government that has 52,000 people waiting for service, I would think the service system is not sustainable.
How do we get beyond that mentality of dictating what people with disabilities need rather than listening to them?
I don't know how you get beyond that. It used to be much easier. Certainly, the Ford government is not interested at this point in hearing that. They said eventually they'll consult with people with disabilities and families later. After, of course, this means after the service system structure has already been created. So I don't know how you do that. We contact the ministry, we request meetings. I have met with some of the ministry staff people, and they're really not interested in what we have to say.
So
I don't know how you do that. I wish I did. And I've been, as I say, I've been involved since the beginning, since 1992 and before that.
So
it used to be much easier than it is now.
So what would the most critical change be if you could see anything enacted for people with disabilities as a protection and a support for these families? What would it be?
Well, there is actually three things that I personally feel and the organization feels that are important. The first one is having a voice at that table. Having people with disabilities and their loved ones having a voice in how the Journey to Belonging is going to be implemented. Right now, that's not happening. The service providers are creating the structure for Journey to Belonging. The next one would be what we call supported decision making. Right now, if you're a person with an intellectual disability, to get certain things, your family member has to deem you incompetent and apply for guardianship over you so that they can get basic services, some basic services. A really good example is, you know, I was helping my daughter apply for the new dental program, and I made an error in checking a wrong box. So at this point, I can no longer change that. They said I shouldn't have been helping her in the first place, and I can't change it because I have not got guardianship over my daughter. So guardianship to me essentially would remove her legal right as a person to be involved in any decisions that she makes in her life. And I don't think that is something that I can do. I believe that all people have a way that they communicate their wishes, their desires, their interests to those people who know them best, whether that's service providers or families or best friends. You can understand what a person wants by their, even those people who don't speak, by their expressions, by their the way that they communicate, because all people do communicate. So again, the only mechanism in place is guardianship. And so we don't agree with guardianship. We wanted a form of supported decision-making in place where those people most connected to that person would help that person make decisions for themselves. And that is a much safer way, because guardianship, of course, one person has guardianship over another person. They make all the decisions. Supported decision-making is a group of people helping that person make decisions for themselves. And the third one would be implementation of direct individualized funding. So right now, the only direct individualized funding for people with disabilities who are adults is passport funding. So irrelevant of your how much support you would require, the maximum you can get is $42,000. And people are on waiting lists for that passport funding. So if you need any additional funding, it must go through a service provider, which means that you are at the whim of the service provider and the ministry telling you what needs to happen. A really good example is the crisis intervention prevention training, which teaches people, staff, how to restrain people. My staff person that goes through an agency must be trained every year in how to restrain my daughter. I don't believe anyone needs restraints. My daughter certainly doesn't. And I would make it clear that if someone did restrain her, then they could no longer work with her. And this person that's supporting my daughter has been with her for over 30 years, and knows her extremely well. So to me, that's a waste of money. It's a waste of time. And I need to fill in when her supporter is going to training that I don't want her to have and that she doesn't need. So that's just a really good example of when service providers, when you have to go through service provision to make that happen. Now, I will say that's not the service providers wanting that to happen. It really is coming from the ministry. Every organization, every service provider must provide restraints training to every single one of their staff people. So you can imagine how much that costs per year, never mind whether people need it or not. So if people were provided with direct funding, I think you would find a number of things. You would find it would be less costly because the funding would come directly to the family. Then the family could purchase the services of an organization or they could hire somebody themselves. It's up to them. That in itself creates a safety mechanism for people. And I'm talking about people who are the most vulnerable, people with disabilities. So if you had control over the money, you would have control, much more control over the service that is provided to that person. So that is one of the really important things that Family Alliance Ontario believes in, is ensuring that people themselves have the control over the money that they are provided for the supports that they require. And this has been done all over the world. The Ontario government knows how to do it. They just, at this point, don't seem willing to move ahead with it. I've been around a long time. I've been fighting for individualized funding for approximately 45 years. So we've been talking about individualized funding, direct funding, for 45 years. If you can't create an individualized funding mechanism in 45 years, I don't have a lot of faith that you can do it now. And families and people with disabilities themselves have been told, well, just give us time. Just give us time. Well, we've always given them time. You know, it was supposed to come into effect a couple of years ago. And now they're saying, well, we need 10 more years. I'm about to turn 75. I don't have 10 more years. So I don't know what more we can do to ensure that people with disabilities are safe and have control over their lives.
Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Writing Support Desk is a free service available for all U Windsor students from all disciplines and levels of study. The Writing Support Desk helps students hone their writing and editing skills to empower them to submit their best work possible. It also helps students understand assignment prompts, construct strong arguments, and properly cite sources. The Writing Support Desk can provide one-on-one consultations in person, on the first floor of Leti Library, and online on Microsoft Teams. For the most up-to-date information, visit uwindsor.ca/writing support.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Betty Daly told us a little bit about the Family Alliance. In this segment of our show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us an update on Thrive magazine. So what were some of the high points for Thrive for this past year?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, Cam, and thanks for having me. I look at it as more globally across our Disability Today publishing network, certainly with Thrive as we continue to grow and impact folks, those personal stories of how something they read, something they came across in Thrive, changed their life, changed their perspective, got them back into a sport, back to work. So it's those personal stories that are most rewarding, that feedback that we get. You know, there's that. We launched a new e-learning course this year, late last year, but it really got some traction here in 2025. It's called Disability Literacy 101, Inclusion Education for the Workplace. So it's starting to get some traction too with corporations, and it's about allyship. You know, we look at, call them the usual suspects of you know, disability life, ableism and unconscious bias, disability etiquette, something we call inspiration exhaustion, when those no praise necessary microaggressions kind of build up and can take a toll on us. So yeah, we launched that, and we got funding to reiterate it for the Ontario's post-secondary education sector. So So we've been busy here in 2025.
So it's interesting you mentioned about use of personal stories. I'd imagine that plays a big role in some of the course material you mentioned, in so much as people will ignore a dry set of facts or a statistic, but it's a lot harder when someone says, I've lived through this. This is surreal to me. This is what happened, and this is why we need to change it.
Absolutely. But I've always been a print publisher, some digital, of course, with our publications, but the foray into the realm of e-learning was very different for me. And, you script for it differently, but to your point, where it started, my wife is a nurse, and come home one day and said, you know, I just had to take the disability training course, and I mean, you had to. You've lived with someone with a disability for 30 years, and she said it was just so dry, and it just really, wasn't representative of the authenticity, the lived experience of our community. It's just, I really don't think it's sending the right message. So that was my all pass or my green light to go to work on a new project. And what we did, we brought in 20 subject matter experts, all with disabilities, all with very different disabilities, to speak to those usual suspects that I mentioned, particularly on how microaggressions, how that unconscious bias, how disability language impacts them personally in their lives. So it's very much about storytelling. A big component is video vignettes in it, where you're hearing from real-life people with disabilities explaining how we could do better.
What's interesting about that is, when it comes to disability language, I know from personal experience, you're never going to make everyone happy, but there are those who prefer one term, one versus another. So I'm guessing that there's some coverage of that sort of use of person-first language.
Definitely. That was our most challenging module. There are 9 different modules in the course, and semantics, disability language, really was, because it's so personal. And it's so dynamic, always changing. So we looked at person-first language. We addressed identity-first language and talked about how that's, a representation of our pride and the culture of our community. You know, we talk about bad language, the words we don't want to use anymore, and euphemisms, too, like this differently abled and physically challenged. And as one of our cast members talked about, Unstoppable Tracy, who many might know from her A-list speaking career.
Oh, I know.
Don't sugarcoat it. I have a disability. It doesn't help to try and make that sound less harsh. It's not harsh to me. So, it was really poignant in some of the comments about language, but it was a challenge. And some people still refer to themselves with words that I don't, and I don't choose to, but it's their personal preference, and I have to respect that.
So, what's your hope for all the work that's going into the year ahead?
Well, certainly we want to continue getting mindset into corporate workplaces, into classrooms, in colleges and universities. We already had calls for additional content, supplementary content to it, and we did, in the last quarter here, release sort of a subset of the Disability Literacy 101 called Disability Accessibility Essentials, The Power of Universal Design. So looking at, how to make documents accessible, how to make your social media accessible. So that's very corporate-driven, too. And then we're also getting requests for neurodiversity in the workplace, which is, I don't want to say a hot topic. That doesn't address it correctly, but new, refreshing attention to that sort of faction of our disability community and organizations wanting to learn more, wanting to be better allies and accommodate, the different skill sets and needs of folks with neurodiversity.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
My pleasure, Ken.
My friends, Betty's absolutely right that when it comes to making promises to the disability community, those promises have to be meaningful and fulfilled.
giving choices to persons with disabilities, allowing them to act with their own intelligence, strength, and dignity, is vital. But you can't just give them a pat on the head and a fistful of empty promises. People don't have the time, the resources, what have you, just to wait for a better day that might never come. Instead, it's incumbent upon all of us to bring that better day into reality. This is where I've always stressed the idea of disability unity. If groups would come together as a united voice, one presence, one goal, to make things better for the disability community, they might actually accomplish something. I would speculate that never in the history of recorded time have ego and infighting ever really solved a problem. And honestly, disability matters are everyone's matters. Politicians might not put disabilities on the priority list, but one could argue that's incredibly short-sighted, because if not themselves, then someone they care about either will be or has been affected. It's not up to us to say only those who move a certain way, see a certain way, hear a certain way, think a certain way are worthy of consideration in society. No, we have to be better than that. We have to look at the totality of our communities. We have to ask ourselves, as business leaders, will someone with a disability want to use this business someday? As educational leaders, we have to look and say, this is accommodating to one student, but is it in such a way that anyone can have an equal chance of succeeding? In religious societies, is this a place where we look at the person and not see them as a task to check off of our charity list or something that needs fixing? In our relationships, we have to look, is this just a disability that we see? Or is it a complete person? Is it someone who might actually enhance my own living experience? Is this someone who can offer me a new perspective? You start to see those things. You start to see why disability policies, funding options, what have you, why these things matter, and what makes it a priority. Disability life is no more or less entitled than any other group in society. Equal representation is the only way we're ever going to make progress. If you see it as trying to take too much or being doormats, either way, you end up accomplishing really nothing. But when people with disabilities share their lived experience as parts of families, as parts of the community, they share these experiences with dignity, strength, and resolve. You start to see the disability itself is just one part of a very complex tapestry. No one person is just one thing. And remembering that, we recognize people with disabilities, they have families, they have people who love them, they have origin stories, maybe they were just like you in many ways, right up until that one momentary anomaly. And we have to ask ourselves, does that one moment in time take away their worthiness? Does it make them somehow less than me? Does it somehow make them less worthy of that consideration? The answer is invariably, no, it doesn't. It makes them a person of strength, someone who has survived something. And moreover, it makes them someone who still has potential towards the future. We can't define what a person will become, and it is not our place to limit their opportunity to explore that. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.